Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thank you so much for coming to this year's Star Cane President's Lecture. It is my great honor and privilege to introduce the Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt. Not only has she served as the president of Star Cane for the past year, before this she was the senior minister at the Fourth Universalist Society in the city of New York, my own congregation, for 14 years. And before that she had a long and esteemed career in journalism, working for publications such as Ms., Essence, and the New York Times. She is the mother of two and the wife of a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, Robert McNatt. She is a woman of great faith and vision and courage, and it has been my joy and honor to serve under her at Star King. So without further ado, may I introduce the Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. Most of you have come today to hear me speak about Unitarian Universalist multi-religious reality. I won't be talking about that at all today. And I'm sorry. Some of you may have come to hear me talk about the flurry of social media and tabloid journalism swirling around Star King this year. I won't be talking about that at all. And I am not sorry. Finally, I would not be doing my duty as a trauma and disaster chaplain if I did not advise you that some of what I say today may be too graphic for some members of the audience. And so I please want you to know that you may want to excuse yourself during certain parts of this talk. I don't think it will be too graphic, but I feel it is my responsibility to mention that to you. My reading this afternoon is from the book of Mark in the Christian scriptures, chapters 4, verse 16 through 20. And these are the ones sown on rocky ground. When they hear the word, they immediately receive it with joy. But they have no root and endure only for a while. Then when trouble or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. And others are those sown among the thorns. These are the ones who hear the word, but the cares of the world and the lure of wealth and the desire for other things come in and choke the word, and it yields nothing. And these are the ones sown on the good soil. They hear the word and accept it and bear fruit, 30 and 60 and 100-fold. Imagine your Tuesday night covenant group in your home congregation, the circle with its single empty chair to remind the group that it needs to remain open to new people. Imagine lighting your chalice just as a stranger arrives to participate in this session's reflection on grace, perhaps, or mercy. Imagine sharing your thoughts, perhaps hearing from the stranger a few words on the reflection topic. Imagine extinguishing the chalice and finding yourself at the other end of a gun. Imagine yourself being murdered in what was meant to be the safest place you knew. Imagine being targeted because you were white. Imagine that it isn't the first time, or the 10th time, or the 100th time, or the 1,000th time. Imagine never feeling safe anywhere, at any time, ever. Welcome to African American life in the 21st century. 1 week ago yesterday, a 21-year-old racist terrorist walked through the doors of Emmanuel AME Church and joined a Bible study group led by the church's pastor. They welcomed this stranger, this newcomer, into their midst. The pastor asked him to sit down next to him. Together, they read and reflected on the text I just read to you from Mark. And when they were done, this terrorist took out a gun and methodically shot most of the people in that room. He allowed one person to live so that she might witness to his atrocity. DePayne Middleton Doctor, Cynthia Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lance, the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, Tawanza Sanders, Reverend Dr. Daniel Simmons, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, Reverend Myra Thompson. Those are their names. Today marks the first of their 9 funerals. And each day, as their funeral processions move through Charleston, their mourning families and friends will ride down streets named after honored Confederate generals. The pastor's funeral corsage will move to his church from the state capitol, where he has been lying in state and where the Confederate flag flies at full staff, padlocked to the flagpole by law. The perpetrator of this massacre left on his personal page a 2,500-word manifesto about his motive and his inspiration. Part of this screed was reported in the New York Times as follows. "I have no choice," he wrote. "I am not in the position to alone go into the ghetto and fight. I chose Charleston because it is the most historic city in my state, and at one time had the highest ratio of blacks to whites in the country. We have no skinheads, no real KKK, no one doing anything but talking on the internet. Well, someone has to have the bravery to take it to the real world, and I guess that has to be me." It's a safe bet, at least I hope it is, that no one in this room believes the words of this racist killer. But how many among us seriously engage with the words in the book of Mark? The Bible study that night at Mother Emmanuel was somewhere on the screen. Was a continuation of the parable of the sower. The seeds being sown were the words of God. And Jesus is continuing to explain to his disciples about the word of God, about the faith that they engender and the actions that result. We of liberal faith in this hall are no different than the soil on which the seeds have fallen. We might understand them as seeds of love and liberation and challenge. And only you will know how you have responded or continue to respond. When the seeds of liberatory work fall on the ground of your heart, are you excited to hear and understand until you glimpse what lies ahead? Are you the person who lives blithely with your privilege, ready to walk away as soon as the work becomes tough or is not sufficiently rewarding for you? Or are you part of the easily distracted, interested in the work of justice, but choked by the seductions of a world in denial, a world designed to help you stay unconscious? Or are you ready and willing and able to engage, shored up by comrades in the work and partners in spiritual practice to sustain you when things are tough or even impossible? I have wanted to write or talk about the events of Charleston since the day they happened, and I have been mute until now. The depth and breadth and sorrow and rage and horror that I have felt in response to these murders is hard to overestimate. And it is joined with my sorrow and horror and rage about so many other murders. The murders of Trayvon Martin and Eric Garner, the murders of Tamir Rice and Renisha McBride, the murders of Rekia Boyd and Tanisha Anderson and Yvette Smith and Tony Robinson and Miriam Carey and Michael Brown and Dontre Hamilton, and we could be here all day with me reading names. All day. In an irrational sense, it is also fear that has kept me silent. The foolish idea that if only I don't think about it happening to my husband or my sons, I will keep the evil spirits of white supremacist culture at bay for one more day. Unless I am at work at Star King, I often feel alone in this religious community that I love and to whom I have given my life. Because often people of color and whites do not even have a common language of oppression to guide our work and our lives together. Because every effort at social justice necessarily begins with an act of translation and is just as often met with an act of denial. And the dance of understanding takes so long it hardly feels worth it. It is at these moments that I remember that I actually volunteered for this life assignment. I married into Unitarian Universalism, and this faith captured my spirit much as my beloved husband captured my heart. And it was only years later, in a seminary class on the public practice of ministry, that I realized what a crazy, terrible thing I had done. My professor at the time, who was a white woman, was walking with us through a study of repentance and its root meanings. She told us a story of her own ministry, a story of a white man in her congregation who was friends with a black man, also a member of the congregation. The two men worked together at the same company, and both men were up for a coveted promotion. She spoke of a counseling session she had with the white man after his black friend got the job. As she spoke about trying to help this man repent, to turn, as she spoke about that white man's pain and rage at losing his promotion, as she told of his outrage that his friend, that nigger is what he really said, had taken his job, and his terrible shame and surprise to discover how racist he was at his core, I found myself sobbing in awful recognition. As a future minister in this painfully white denomination, I was being called to minister to people just like her congregant, shame-filled, raging, privileged, entitled, as we heard earlier this week, overserved people. I did not know how I could bear it. I did not know how to be released. In truth, I cannot be released, and I have not been. I have accepted my call, and at the same time, I have made promises to myself about this unexpected ministry. Promises that I work hard to keep. First among them is to say what I know to be true, most importantly, to myself. I know that I must hold a line that many religious professionals of color must hold for ourselves, a line that even in its maintenance reveals how evil and how pernicious racism is. I must always watch for the moment when my pastoral care of someone becomes spiritual domestic work. cleaning up behind someone's unformed understandings of privilege. It's almost always around issues of race. It's almost always around tough conversations about the acknowledgement of white privilege or next steps for confronting racism. They seem always to be conversations with women, and those women are almost always middle-aged or older. They sometimes happen with men, but those conversations are largely marked by anger and denial. With women, the changes are invariably marked by tears and a sense of helplessness that even the woman in question may not know seems exaggerated. Almost always, there is a pleading look, a request, spoken or unspoken, that I take this cup from her. Save her from the work of self-examination or self-condemnation. Clean up her part of a mess from which she benefits the vast majority of the time. It used to trouble me, and then it angered me. And now I know it for the passing phenomenon that it is, an expression of what the writer Dr. Robin DiAngelo of the University of North Carolina in Greensboro calls white fragility. Dr. DiAngelo speaks of it thusly. White people in North America live in a social environment that protects and insulates them from race-based stress. This insulated environment of racial protection builds white expectations for racial comfort while at the same time lowering the ability to tolerate racial stress, leading to what I refer to as white fragility. She continues, white fragility is a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves. These moves include the outward display of emotions such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, and leaving the stress-inducing situation. These behaviors, in turn, function to reinstate white racial equilibrium. If you have not read this paper, please do. I believe that white who are serious about countering oppression and doing the work of liberation will first need to build their resilience to combat the culturally supported state of fragility. And Robin DiAngelo's will do, I think, for this next generation of counter-oppressive work, what Peggy McIntosh's famous essay on white privilege did for the previous generation of this work. Amid the race-related horror show that has been these last 18 months, it has been salvific for me to reconnect to Star King after 15 years and to be chosen to lead the school. Whenever I review the materials about our educational model, our commitment to educate to counter oppressions and to create just and sustainable communities, I am reminded of all it took to arrive at that place, how difficult it was to do, and how much it cost all of those of us who believed in the task. The school began this journey more than 20 years ago. I was a brand new trustee on the board, and the entire board was at work on a process of board education and discernment led by the amazing and wonderful Clark Olson. We were more fortunate than we knew to be led by Clark in a process that would help us determine what kind of theological school we hoped to recreate. He knew intimately the price we might pay if we were serious about challenging an oppressive system, even one we were part of. If you are in this room, Clark, and even if you are not, I want to thank you. The leadership you offered the board and Rebecca in the mid-1990s laid the groundwork for all of the counter-oppressive work at Star King that followed right into the present day. and as a true warrior for justice, you are never far from my thoughts. We worked together under Clark's and Rebecca's combined leadership to reimagine the school in the service of the beloved community in which we longed to live. We discerned that among the most important things we could do was to create a school that worked actively against the evils of racism and sexism, homophobia and classism, by endeavoring to model this in our faculty and staff, in our board, and among our students. We did a faculty search that advanced that goal at great emotional and financial cost to the school. And long after I left the board, the school, under Rebecca's leadership and along with Ibrahim Farajajeh, continued to pursue that goal, creating the educational model we now employ, a model that challenges assumptions and equips our students to think critically and act compassionately in the service of liberation. There has never been a greater need for religious leaders with the capacity to do the work of justice in a country and in a world suffering from fatal doses of the poison that is racism. We at Stark King are committed to raising up those leaders, sending them out into congregations and communities to serve the cause of justice and freedom and love. We know why we are here and what we are here to do, and we will continue to do it with all the strength and enthusiasm and love that we can give to the task. My question for you is, what are you willing to do? Are you willing to give up your silence and your complicity? Are you willing to be less fragile in your whiteness and more resilient? Are you ready to face the ugly voice that may be planted in your head and perhaps your heart and repent and turn around and turn away from the white supremacist culture you were taught not to notice and turn toward a new way that we might build together? If you are ready, we are ready for you. And the world we can imagine together is the world we must attain. Let these few words of mine, then, fall not on the stony ground of resistance, but on the fertile soil of change, so that it might bear fruit among all of us, 30 and 60 and 100-fold. Thank you.
Is it working? Good.
We have time, if you would like, for some reflections about your own journey, about your own capacities for this work, your own successes, your own failures, if you feel comfortable in sharing those. There is a mic in the center of the room. And if you would like to have a conversation, I'd be happy to join in that conversation with you. Just line up behind the mic. Say your name, if you would, please, so I can address you.
I'm Maggie Ingalls.
Hi, Maggie Ingalls.
As a member of the white privileged, I don't know how to do this. So I need help getting started. And thank you so much for your beautiful speech.
Thank you, Maggie. What I want to say to you is the fact that you don't know what to do is actually a pretty good start, because it means that you're open to learning from people and groups. I want to encourage you to be in conversation with other white people who have the same concerns and cares that you do, perhaps in a religious setting. I actually believe it's more important to do this in a religious community. I believe that it's the place where we're best able to be vulnerable about something that we're really vulnerable about. And that there are lots of things you can start reading. I suggest that article by Robin DiAngelo to begin. And work hard to educate yourself around these things. It's okay not to know.
Thank you.
My name is Julia Hamilton. I'm a minister in Santa Barbara, California, and I wanted to model private failure publicly in a theme that we've been talking about amongst our ministers. In Santa Barbara, there is a story that there are no black people in Santa Barbara. It's not true. And when all of this started unfolding, I started showing up at some of the vigils and marches, just showing up to see who I would meet, see who was there. And I met another pastor who I had never met before, and he was introduced to me as from Oxnard, which is about 45 minutes south of Santa Barbara. So I started with the question that you often ask when you meet somebody who you think is new: how long have you been in Santa Barbara? What brings you up here? I haven't met you before. His family is from Santa Barbara, going back several generations. He's been serving in Santa Barbara. I just hadn't met him before. He has a dual pastorate in Oxnard and Santa Barbara. And I could tell the minute I asked him that question, I stepped into a space that he is confronted with every day of his life, which is assuming that he is a foreigner in his hometown, the town where he was raised, where he is raising his children, because he doesn't look like people's image of Santa Barbara. And I was mortified. I wanted to fall through the earth. I wanted to never talk to him again and hide behind a tree every time I saw him. And I had to get over that to rebuild a bridge with him so that we could work together in this town that we shared. And so I wanted to just share that private failure publicly to encourage other people to get over that fear that I could easily have just run from and never spoken with him again. So I just encourage you all to just keep getting up.
Thank you, Julie.
Hi, Rosemary. Alexa Fraser, a Star King seminarian.
Hi, Alexa. How are you?
Hi. Good to see you. Good to see you.
Very good to see you.
I recently read a blog by Tom Shade in The Lively Tradition. I don't know if it's one that you saw, but it was a really very, very interesting blog about white people and racism. And in addition to the list of reactions coming out of discomfort around the topic of racism that you gave, in addition to that list, he had another, which was white people getting angry at each other for not doing enough, but in a way that actually increases vulnerability around doing the wrong thing to the point that maybe you just decide to go home. And I think it's called something like Don't Yell at the Vegetables. And also using a metaphor that involved ground and raising the quality of the soil to grow better vegetables was part of the theme. At any rate, I think I just wanted to hold that up. I didn't know if you were familiar with that particular blog or if you had any thought about that phenomena, which I think is some congregations are at risk of divisions that tie to that.
Thank you. I did not see that particular blog post, but I know Tom's work very well, and I read it whenever I can. I didn't see that piece, but it does sound familiar. There is certainly around a lot of social justice issues, but definitely around the issues of race. There are always people in a congregation who are further along on the path and are less accepting of people who haven't gotten there yet. And it's a danger. It is a genuine danger. And when my mentor, Charlie Ortman, and I used to do work around this in congregations and in communities, we used to talk about two principles that we thought were very important, and that was honesty and amnesty. Honesty, because you needed to be able to speak your truth in a setting with people who were on the same path with you, and amnesty, you needed to be gracious about the possibility that people would say incredibly stupid things on their way to getting this work done, and you needed to have some mercy because it would be your turn one day to say something profoundly embarrassing. And I think that we don't do that enough around every issue that we work on. We keep forgetting what James Luther Adams tells us, that church is where we practice what it means to be human. It's one of my favorite things to remember. And there's nowhere where this is more important than issues of race. So, okay. Yes.
My name is Sylvia Wheeler, and I come from First Church San Antonio. First, I want to say that I came from a biological family of a father who was incredibly bigoted and racist, and a mother who had just given up. So when I first went to GA in Charlotte in 1993, I was absolutely blown away. And if you weren't there, you can't imagine what it was like. So I have a question for you, Rosemary. Recently, when Barack Obama made his comments about the Charleston situation, whatever you want to call it, he used language that I learned later on in life, since my father used the same language consistently and constantly. I don't understand what the big deal was about the language he used. And here I personally am referring to his use of the word nigger. What's the big deal? That's my question. Thank you.
I don't know what the big deal was that you're referring to, although I suspect it's because the word has such charged potential for every situation. As you said it, I winced. No matter how much I know better, I know we're in a situation where we're talking about something very specific. There is never a time when someone white says that word that I don't twitch. I don't feel that same way when black people say it. Part of that is contextual, part of that is cultural, part of that has, there's a whole range of things that are about that. I believe that his saying the word touched a nerve for people, in part because that may be what they're calling him when they're at home, and also because it breaks denial. We're not supposed to be talking about this. We're not supposed to be thinking about this. This is over. We have a black president. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Go back to your amusements. Everything is fine. So I think that that is what triggered a lot of the hysteria. He broke a rule about how he was supposed to just blend in. We, you know, it's kind of like, we let one of you through. You need to be grateful and have a seat. That's what I think. You're welcome. We also want to say, if you can't get up to the mic for any reason, let us know. And Dee, standing on my right, will bring you the mic.
Hi, my name is Peggy Jenkins. I am a member of Unitarian Universalist Church of the Palouse in Moscow, Idaho. But I wanted to share a story, an ongoing story of my white fragility evolving from white fragility. I recently reconnected with my college roommate. She's African American, and we had done some nice little things lately, but she called me in January and asked me if I wanted to go to a spa with her in St. George, Utah. It was her idea, it wasn't my idea, and it was actually a lovely place, and she was one of the only African American people there, and we were sitting at the communal dining table, and about an hour into the meal, she got up and left, and I remember thinking about it and thinking, I think she was upset, I don't know, I didn't really understand why. And I talked to her the next day, and she said, I very much was upset. There were things being said that were very threatening to me. In particular, they were threatening to me as the only African-American person there in the whole place, it felt like. And she said, and you were not a good ally. And she explained to me why the things that were said and the way that I reacted that was not helpful. And we go back a long way, and she loves me. And it was funny, the next day we went on a hike through Zion, and the guide, who was a very nice woman, I don't know, it's one of those things, she said something, it was like, oh, I get it now. I get it now. And it's a learning experience. And she's now going to come visit me in Moscow, Idaho. So the learning experience is going to continue. I think she's going to take Moscow, Idaho by storm. So it's going to be great.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Bill Klingelhofer from San Francisco.
Hello.
Thank you for addressing the whole horrible thing in your talk. I'm sure it's caused you a lot of pain, and I haven't heard anybody say anything about it until now, so thank you for doing that. I'm sorry. But my question for you is something a little more trivial, but maybe you'd call it white fragility, and maybe you can help me out with it. We're always confronted with little forms we have to fill out, you know, and we're supposed to check off what race we are. And I'm European American, so I look at this and I always used to just, well, check off, oh, I'm white. And then I realized I was getting a little charge out of that, you know, like, well, I'm white. Oh, and I don't like that. I don't like feeling like I'm superior, so because I can check off white on that government form. But I know that the government forms are there so that they can do their racial calculations and figure out stuff they need to figure out, I suppose. I just don't like doing it. So I check off other and write something else. But what do you suggest? How do you suggest I deal with this little trivial thing?
I think it's a trivial thing. I don't think it's a trivial thing that you can run away from by checking other. The issue is about how you feel, not about checking the box. It's about the feelings you're having when you're checking the box. And that's internal work for you. What if you're feeling superior and you don't like feeling superior, then that's the work right there, not refusing to check the box. And that requires more spiritual work on your part, because that's a spiritual issue. All of what we're talking about here, ultimately, is a spiritual issue. It's about what the culture has done to us that has infiltrated our spirit and kept us from this fuller knowledge of our humanity. You feel superior because the whole culture encourages you to feel that way. And if you don't want to feel that way, it can be different, but not without work on your part. So you have to start somewhere.
Where do you suggest I start?
At that article that I told you to read. The title is called White Fragility. White Fragility. It's by Robin DiAngelo. She's at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Yes.
I think this is another white fragility question, and I hope I get amnesty if this is an incredibly stupid thing to ask. But
this is an amnesty space.
Okay, thank you. I'm Carl Poninen, a member of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Greater Lansing, and also a member of the Church of the Larger Fellowship. As somebody, you know, I certainly identify as a Euro-American or European-American, as I'm an American citizen, but my ancestors came from Europe. Something I struggle with in anti-racism work, I struggle with wondering, is there still a way that I can legitimately celebrate the heritage of my own ancestors who came to this country from Europe? Can I celebrate that heritage without it degenerating into racism or going to a really unthinkable extreme like what happened in Charleston? How do I celebrate my heritage without becoming a part of what happened in Charleston?
I think it's really important for people of who are white to understand what their heritage actually is, because whiteness is a construct like everything else that we're talking about here. And people aren't just white. They're kind of German or Swedish and some combination, or Scottish or Irish or any of those things. And I think it's important to kind of understand what your heritage is. And there's a certain amount of envy, I think, among some African Americans, because we don't have a level of specificity about who we are. That was taken from us. You know, now there's this whole DNA thing where you can kind of go and track, and I keep wanting to do it, but I have all these bioethical questions about what they're going to do with my DNA, so I haven't done it yet. That's a whole other essay. But I think it's really important that you begin by understanding who you are. I think that actually can mitigate against some of this kind of sweeping, I'm better because I'm white stuff. And having a legitimate understanding of your heritage is a good thing. I think that it's important for people to know where they come from and who they are, and what there is in their families and in their heritages to be proud of. It doesn't automatically become a racist act. Does that help? Okay.
Hi, Rosemary. You know me, but my name is
Erin
White, and I'm the president-elect at Fourth Universalist Society in New York.
Okay.
And I just had a reflection because I've identified now as a Unitarian Universalist for 5 years. And unlike a lot of people, I didn't come to this faith looking for a way to act on social justice. I kind of, for a long time, stepped away from that because I always thought that while I agreed with what the ultimate, you know, goal was, it seemed so impractical. It seemed like there was no point. But this last year has changed that for me. I have gone to my first protest, my first march, my first vigils, and multiple now, and have started to find something in this faith that is some answer. It is not the answer. I don't know what the answer is, but last week we had a vigil for the Charleston shooting, and we were sitting in the small chapel at the church and saying, basically, what do you do? Because you go on Facebook, and most of my friends agree with me, and you just talk to everyone who agrees with you already. And someone said, well, we could go outside. And that's something we've started doing more, is going outside of the church and standing on Central Park West. And we held the vigil out there, and we had the candles, and then we decided to hold the entire service out there and stood there with hymn books and sang. And people joined us that walked by. Some of the cab drivers said thank you, people on bikes. It was a powerful experience. And I do not think it is an answer to any of this, but it's a reason to keep going. And so I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so proud. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Diana Diggs, and
Hi,
I'm
Diana.
From the Theodore Parker Church in West Roxbury, Mass. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much to that last person for that great idea. I'm up here asking for an idea as well. Our congregation has committed to a year of study of white privilege, organized around the book Waking Up White, and I think we will add the white fragility article as well. But my question is, if there's anybody in the room who has done this kind of study, and if you have some tips or ideas to share with me, I'll stand at the exit door and maybe you could share your thoughts. And thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you. And let's do some crowdsourcing. Please meet her by the door. That'd be good. Hello.
Hello. My name is Ben Ramsdestein. I know you already, but for the audience. Okay. Being raised in this faith, it's alarming to me, even over the last decade mostly, how much this still has seeped in and how much work I have left to do. And the rest of what I have to say I wrote down because I knew I'd get too nervous to be able to remember everything. My heart is trying to beat itself out of my chest, asking me to stay seated, say nothing, or leave. I just want, excuse me, I just want to say, as someone with privilege trying to better understand my own privilege and oppression in general, as well as specifically in the lives of those around me, I've definitely made the mistake of angering others by trying to make those who are oppressed teach me about their oppression and about my privilege, rather than doing the work on my own. I just wanted to acknowledge your generosity and grace in doing that for us, and with us right now in the room today. Thank you. Many of us will never understand how uncomfortable this process and moment is for you right now, even if we weren't clouded by our own discomfort.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you. Hello.
Hi. My name is Babs Eskin. I'm a longtime member of the UU Church of Fresno, 1968.
Wow.
And I grew up during the Second World War in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we lived on the Jewish main line. There was actually a line separating Philadelphia, a city line. On the other side was Bryn Mawr and media and the real American Jewish main line. And I remember the first time I felt shame, because I didn't know anybody who was black. But on Wednesday morning, my mother would put me in the car, and we would drive two blocks away to the corner of Burke Street and Lebanon Avenue. And there lined up would be black women who had their lunch packed, and they were getting in the car to go for day work at whoever picked them up. And it was something like the farm workers in Fresno, and where you can go and see them lined up to be taken to any place. They don't know where, they don't know how they're going to be treated. And I remember being in that car, and I was five, and I felt such awful shame. And I didn't know where, but I knew it was my mother, and my mother wasn't like that, I thought. But anyway, that was then. And then I grew up, but I didn't know anybody who was black until I went to high school. And there, I went to high school with Wilt Chamberlain, and I joined the choir, and everybody was just human. Everybody was different colors, and it was beautiful. And then I went on to do a lot of civil rights work, and I went to March on Washington in 63, and I did what I did, and I was on the East Coast, and a lot of places where I lived were really integrated, and that was nice. And then we moved out here, well, to Fresno, and it was a southern town. It was really hard for me. And I went to city council meetings. I was good at that, and Board of Education, and helped start the first integrated school. And our kids went, and that was good. And I thought of myself as, I was happy in that. Right now I have black neighbors on either side of my street, of my house. I've lived there for all these years in that house, but it didn't get integrated till people got money to move other places than where they lived. They actually all lived across the tracks. And what I find, although I have good friends now who are black, my neighbors and a preacher in my town who, when we met in interfaith work, she said, "I never met anybody like you." And I said, "I never met anybody like you." And we got together and we lunched and we talked. And we were both a little scared when she asked me, "Well, what does God mean to you?" And I thought, "Well, what?" Well, and we started that conversation. And I've been a member of the NAACP since 1980. And you
so
know,
how
I
can I help?
Well, the pain is, I was going to a section I'd never been in before, and it was to an African American church that I had never been before, and I didn't have GPS and I didn't know where I was going, and the streets were empty, except, and there were no cars mostly, and except for, I saw African-American men, black men, walking on the street, not together, you know, one at a time. And I stopped and asked directions, and every single one of them was nice to me and told me where to go and told me how to do it. And one of the things that I did when I went home was I said, you know, I was all alone and I didn't know where I was going and it was dark, and everybody I talked to was so nice. And I thought, why am I thinking that? You know, why would I wonder about that? But I said it. And then I thought about time somewhere where I'm out someplace, and I still wonder if maybe I should cross the street. And I don't want to think like that.
But you know, I want to interrupt you and say that what you're describing is not unusual. I bet if you look around, if I asked how many of you have thought that at some point in your lives, it's not unusual. We're taught that.
But I don't like it. I don't like it.
You don't have to like it. You just have to help yourself and gather with others to make a different way for yourself. But thank you for that.
Thank you for being here. I read your book years ago. It changed my life.
Oh,
your biography, your autobiography.
We have about 5 more minutes, right? Oh, 2:30. Oh, no, we have fine. Never mind. Keep talking.
Okay, my name is Charles Halstead, and I'm at the UU Church of Davis, California.
Hello.
Which is a lily white town, although there's a big university there. Mm-hmm. And I'm part of a social justice committee we're just forming, and one of the things we realized, we can't deal with the racism issue locally because there's no blacks in town, but there are quite a few in Sacramento. Now, just jumping back, my history is that in 1966, I lived in Cleveland, Ohio, mm-hmm. and or 1965, and I was very active in the civil rights movement. I was a member of CORE and then NAACP, mm-hmm. and I helped register voters for LBJ, going through a black ghetto in the middle of Cleveland. And then I went to I was asked to be a delegate to a meeting of NAACP, and when I walked in, there were about 50 black, mostly men, and I was the only white person. No one knew what to say to me or how to make me welcome. And I thought to myself, now I know what it's like to be black in America. Because there's this other, to be isolated. Well, our church now is, we're thinking about joining or becoming interactive with one of the black churches in Sacramento. And we haven't really formulated plans yet, but speaking from my experience, how will predominantly black people accept someone from a lily white town in Davis who, are we going to be looked at as bleeding heart liberals or this is the kind of interaction that
I think
you
the
might
answer
have
to that question will depend on the work you do before you meet them.
Right.
I think that paying attention to the reality of your whiteness in this community and being willing to do your own work before you get to this church, and not expecting them to solve the racism problem for you,
will make a difference. I think that reading some of the things I've mentioned and that other people have mentioned in here, waking up white, having those conversations in your congregation, in your social justice group, and getting some of those feelings up and out and some of those questions out and educating yourselves before you gather with that church will make a big difference in how you're able to partner with them. I believe that you will be able to partner with them. How successful it will have a lot to do with the spirit in which you enter into that partnership.
So you do believe we would be able to partner?
I do.
Yeah, okay.
I do.
Okay, right.
But I do believe you will have to do some work first.
Pardon?
I believe you will have to do some work first.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Hello.
Hello. My name is Ross Quinn. I'm currently in the emerging Unitarian Universalist Society of the High Desert in the hardscrabble Victorville, Southern California area.
Okay.
But I grew up in the Ventura Church, so blessings to all of you from there. I am a very privileged, very tall, very dominant white male. I'm more privileged than most because I'm a doctor and I can touch you in ways that most can't, so I'm even more privileged. But I also happen to be, through accident of my life and through some purpose, to be bilingual in Spanish. I'm culturally competent with brown people. I can talk their language. I can use the facial motions. I know what they're saying and how I think with them. I'm not culturally competent. I never lived among black people. And although, you know, I really have tried to plumb my depths, and I don't harbor racism as an outspoken or any seed of that, but I do have the privilege, and that manifests itself, I believe, in ways that are pernicious. Mm-hmm. What's the boundary between being culturally competent and being racist? How can we get more culturally competent? In my circles, I'm a prison physician, by the way, so I'm used to dealing with felons, and there are a large number of black felons where I work in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Mm-hmm. But brown people are also oppressed. They're not lynched. They're not shot as often, mm-hmm. but they're incarcerated and detained, mm-hmm. and their families are mm-hmm. split, and all those horrible things happen. And one of the great sadnesses that I have, as much as we don't see very many black folks, we don't see very many brown people. I'm the gringo con lingo, and I hope that there are others who can respond to that and help bring that into our movement. We need that. Mm-hmm. Any comments?
Let's see. First of all, is this on? Yours is on. Okay, so how's that? Oh, yeah, so much better. Okay, thank you. I think that cultural competence comes from contact and familiarity. One of the questions I always ask people when they say, well, you know, I don't really know any black people, and I want to know how that could be. It seems stunning to me in 2015 that people could make choices about where to live and where to shop and where to go to school and where to work and all these other questions and not in any way find themselves connected in any way to people of color, whether they be black people or other people. So for people who are concerned about their cultural competency, you might want to ask yourself some other more pertinent questions, like how have I structured my life that this could be possible? Because I can't imagine structuring my life that way. It would never occur to me to be the only black family in an all-white town, because I would never have done that to my children. So I wanted my children to live in a multicultural world, so we raised them in New York City. That kind of took care of it. And not everybody's going to run off to New York, but it does mean that you can make decisions in your life that place you in proximity to people that you want to know, and that you can make decisions politically and spiritually about what that's like. I don't think that you can, like, join a meetup group saying, I want to meet black people. I don't think it's going to work that way. And you might be scared. It might be scary, really, if you tried to set up one of those. I don't know how that would work. But I do think that the ways in which we structure our lives are the primary ways that we get through those things. And you may need to be direct with some of the black people you know, or that, do you not know any black people?
No, I know some, but I go to work and I come home and I rest and I go to work again. That's my life.
Ah, okay, so that.
And I go to camp.
Okay.
A bit of a
but
lines.
It may be that you need to alter the way you live your life in order to gain some cultural competency. And only you know how that's going to work, because I don't know the surroundings of your life. But I think that that's the first step. If we're serious about this work, we can't, like, say, okay, so this is one black person I know, and this is the person I'm going to experiment on. Because that's not going to work either. Does that help?
It does. Thank you.
You're welcome. We can take three more questions. I know that's awful.
Okay. Hi, Marjorie. I'm Judith Rue from Montclair, New Jersey.
Yay!
And I feel very privileged to have heard you twice in 1 week, two different coasts. But anyway, what I'm here to say is I'm like probably everybody in this room. I consider myself very enlightened, very progressive. I do a certain amount of social justice work. I raised my kids in Montclair and New York City, mm-hmm. So you know what that means.
I do.
And about 5 years ago, after years of having a different career, I became a professional Tai Chi teacher, would you believe? And I got a phone call about a year ago from I think rather enlightened psychologist at a men's prison in Newark, asking me if I would come and teach Tai Chi. And so I started doing that almost exactly a year ago. Not, you know, I was just sort of found the idea challenging, and I went. And I do it too, do it still. And this has rocked my world, you know. And what I'm feeling, what I'm learning, what I'm experiencing. I had not read Michelle Alexander's book. I bought it. It had been sitting on my shelf for a long time. I read it after this, and there's two aspects to what I'm trying to figure out where to go from here. One is, I actually think I'm doing good stuff in that prison. I think I'm really giving this population, who are, you know, 98% African American, mostly half my age, I'm giving something they want and need. I do really believe that. I also am bearing witness to something most of us white people only read about. I'm seeing mass incarceration. I'm seeing the young guys who get thrown in there for some pretty minor things, some things that my own son has probably done, frankly, a lot of drugs, a lot of, you know, thrown in multiple times. So, because it's a prison where you don't stay very long for the most part. Right. And it's a prison where there's a pretty big therapeutic aspect to the work. So there's a lot of work around drug and addiction issues and family issues. And hence they could bring Tai Chi class too. So I don't know what to do. I feel like I'm just bursting with something to say to audiences like this. And part of me thinks I'm a little bit like, you know, those old movies, Sandy Duncan, Up the Down Staircase, nice white lady goes to teach the poor black children in the inner city. So there's part of that feeling, and I mm-hmm. don't want it to be about that. It's mm-hmm. not about me. It's mm-hmm. about being able to put a human face on something the rest of us mostly just read about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also in all the very justified outrage at the horrendous murders at the hands of police or crazy mm-hmm. white guys. Mm-hmm. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of just young, normal guys sitting there languishing in prison for a pretty small. And mm-hmm. and I feel like somehow that aspect, although we know about it because we've been talking about masculine, that sort of gets lost a little bit. You know, that's the less horrible side of this. It's horrible, but it's not the very horrible murders. And anyway, that's what I have to say.
Well, I think you're in the right church among yeah. almost every church in the world. Montclair is the place where you can do a lot. I don't think you should worry too much about not being the right person. You're seeing something that other people aren't seeing, and you can talk about something in ways other people can't. So use your capacity to do that where you are. It's a great place to start, and have faith that where what you start won't be in vain, because it usually isn't.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, it's falling, okay. Hi, I'm Derek Mustellier, a Star King student.
Hi, Derek.
Hi. First of all, I just had to say I could not be prouder to have you as my president, and just, yeah. I mean, I just want to, like, turn to everyone in the audience and be like, that's my president, y'all. Like, how awesome is she? Yeah. So, now that that's out of the way, my question is sort of in two parts, I suppose, which mm-hmm. is probably not good for the amount of time we have, but I'll give it a shot. The first part is kind of a little bit related to the white fragility aspect. I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about kind of trying to move past this, like, I guess you would call it white paralysis, like this moving from this place of just being so overwhelmed with the systemic racism in our society to a place of taking action and taking first steps to mm-hmm. dismantle that system. Mm-hmm. And then also, if you could talk a little bit about how we as white folks, and particularly white folks, white UUs in this overwhelmingly white faith, how we can make space for people of color, not just practically, but theologically, because there's a lot of theologies that we as UUs mm-hmm. are not very accepting of that mm-hmm. can really turn away a lot of people mm-hmm. of color. So,
those are wonderful questions. I couldn't be prouder that you're a Star King student. I think that the issue of paralysis is very common and completely understandable. There are, I think it's a myth that every black person is ready to jump to the barricades at every moment. As I said in my talk, I was just numb after Charleston. I couldn't even say anything. I remember one afternoon just kind of walking around my house crying. I had nothing to say. I just was. So the paralysis, the overwhelming, feeling overwhelmed by the perniciousness and evil of something is very real. I think we shouldn't pretend that it's not there. I think we should give ourselves space to have that feeling. And then I think we should begin to move past it. I think that it's hard to do this stuff alone. I think it's almost impossible to do it alone. You know, remember that when people were doing the Montgomery bus boycott, they weren't just individuals. People were walking together and they were gathering on their way home from work in the church to sing and to pray and to be with one another before they went home and then got up again and did it again the next day for a year. For a year. And so you can't do this kind of work in isolation. And it's important that we have religious communities to help us do this work together, to have these conversations together so that we strengthen one another to do it, right? So was the second part of that question?
The second part was about
about the
making
theology.
Space.
Well, I think that that's a really important point that Unitarian Universalism is much better at than it used to be. When I became a UU and you encountered theists, the room would erupt. People would start talking about how there's no God and why are you bringing that stuff in here. We have really mellowed. Truly, we have mellowed. And in a place like Star King, where we have a multi-religious student body, you know, it's perfectly normal for us to pray in all these different ways. And I think our congregations are beginning to do that. They are certainly more comfortable with the Christian story, remembering that we are part of the dissenting tradition of Christianity. We do better when we remember that. Christianity is not foreign to us. We are simply part of the dissenting tradition within it. And so we need to own that. We don't have to embrace it for all time, but we at least need to know and understand who we are. It makes it easier to accept people who have a much fuller expression and perhaps a more universalist expression about, for example, who Jesus is. Mm-hmm. So I think we're getting there. I'm glad you didn't see us 20 years ago. So thanks. We have one more person, and we're running late, but I'm going to try to do that. Hi.
Hi. I'm John Tucker from the Berkeley Church.
Hi, John.
Hi. And I want to tell a short story about how insidious this racism is. I was raised in an area where there were no blacks. The gardeners and the housemaids were all Japanese. And I went to school, I went to college. There was one black student from Africa. Then I went in the Navy. And as you line up when you're first inducted, you walk down a gauntlet and they have corpsmen on each side and they shoot your arms full of stuff. And I had a horrendous allergic reaction. And so I went to sick bay and turned myself in. And I was miserable. I wanted some help. And the corpsman said, oh, the doctor will be here in a minute. And so I lay there suffering. And this man walked into the room, and my stomach dropped. He was black. And, of course, he was in a uniform with four gold stripes on his sleeve. He was a full captain. And I was a biology major, so I knew a little bit about why should I be scared of him? But, and because I didn't have any racist experiences when I was growing up, but I picked it up. And I'm in my advanced age, I'm beginning to learn about the details of white privilege, and it's awful. Now we have a neighbor, a black couple, and I have very good friends at church who are black, but I still have that residue when I see several young black males on the corner when I'm coming down the sidewalk. I feel quite uncomfortable, so I'm working on it, but it's just dangerous how you get this.
It is dangerous. And I understand that, although I have two sons, so now when I see young black men walking down the street, I think of my babies, you know? But you're right, it's insidious and it's dangerous, and we have a long way to go. But what's encouraging is that there are so many more tools and so much more awareness than there has ever been. And I want to thank all of you for engaging in this conversation with me. It has been a pleasure.
Can you guys hear me? For anyone who would actually like a copy of Reverend McNatt's lecture today, you can find it on our website in full, www.sksm.edu.
Get up.